Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome to Beyond Brunel. Today we're talking about all things water, and we'll be asking the question, how can we secure a sustainable future for water in the Southwest? Joining me online are Matt Wilden, Director of Infrastructure Development at Wessex Water, and Dave Turner, Coastal Engineer at Moffitt & Nicol. A very warm welcome, Dave and Matt. Dave, please start us off. We're going to discuss integrated water management, and I wonder, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I think what we mean by integrated water management is when we manage our water resources and our water systems within the context of the wider water cycle. So we're not just thinking about one part of the problem. We're not just thinking about how to get flood water away, for example, or we're not just thinking about how to get clean water to people's homes. We're thinking about how that works within the wider water cycle. So what other impacts or benefits there might be of doing that in a more holistic way.
And Matt, how might our approach to water management differ now to when it did in the past?
Well, I think we still sit in silos when it comes to water management. We have, as a society, different groups of people looking at different parts of the water cycle. It might be that they work in water production, they might work in sewerage or sewage treatment, or they might work in fluvial flooding. And actually, as David said, that water is holistic. It goes across the catchment, and often it goes between these different silos. And it's at these handoff points where we are very inefficient and we make bad decisions. So integrated water management is all about saying, actually, it's part of a bigger thing. How can we look at water and its management and its benefits and its risks and its problems together such that solutions are optimized? And I think we are very much siloed as organizations, be it government, be it water companies, be it local authorities. And we've all got our own sort of targets and objectives. And they're all quite similar, but they are slightly different. And we have different funding cycles, funding mechanisms. And this is all about, I guess, taking your hat off of the company or organization you work for and saying, actually, I'm part of a bigger thing. How can we do this going forwards? That is a much better way. Because rainwater, you know, when it lands, it doesn't care which organization's assets it goes through. It just goes where it goes. And we're not very good at managing that because we sit in certain parts of that story. And I think integrated water management is about saying, okay, let's look at it in its entirety.
And I guess, Dave, let's be very clear here. So we're looking at two different sides, if you like. We're looking at the kind of foul network and the freshwater systems, which we've got in place. That's kind of the stuff that Matt's been doing. And equally then, your area is kind of around the rivers and coasts and that sort of stuff. So how is it that we deliver for both customers and the environment, marrying up those two sides?
I think that's where Matt talked about delivering kind of within that system. So in the past, we've perhaps been really focused and really good at delivering on the priorities of a organization within that cycle, whether that's a kind of a water company or a local authority or environment agency type body, but really focused on that one outcome. And that's what the kind of infrastructure we've built has been focused towards. And I think when we talk about integrated and a more integrated and holistic approach, we mean delivering the most efficient in terms of all of those outcomes across the water environment and across the water cycle. So I think a really good example, if you think about how in the past we've delivered drainage, it's been all about getting water away from properties quickly. You know, that's had this approach of, it means that the low flows in the river are lower. It means the water quality in the river are lower because all those pollutants are transported to it. And it means that the river's really flashy in terms of flooding. And then we're moving more and more toward sustainable drainage systems, which seeks to kind of mimic those natural processes. So by encouraging infiltration to the ground, we're slowing flows. There's better base flow during dry periods, and those rivers are less flashy. So it's kind of those organizations and those kind of partnerships delivering projects in the water environment, considering a wider range of outcomes for their project, rather than being kind of as single-minded as we've been in the past.
And Matt, so let's focus a little bit on the consumer here. So we're taking water out of the system. We're using it for, well, H2O to drink. But of course, we're also putting water back into the system. And so what are your priorities in that space?
You're quite right. We're dealing with a legacy system where we rely on one pipe to supply many different functions. And often we rely on one pipe to provide a couple of functions on the drainage side. And that's where the problem stems from, is that every single drop that comes out of your tap is at drinking water standards. And yet the percentage of that you actually drink is tiny. Most of it we use to flush our toilets and to shower in and to wash stuff with. It doesn't need to be drinking water standards. And so we're abstracting water, treating it to a very high standard, pumping it a long way for the consumer to waste the majority of it. Well, that doesn't sit comfortably, does it, when it comes to carbon footprint and a good use of the resources we have. And then on the drainage side, you know, up until the mid-1960s, which is more than half of the properties in England, we used to just mix the rainwater from the roof and the driveway with the sewage. And again, we're expecting a single pipe to provide multiple functions. And then we end up with problems like storm overflows. And it seems to me that the thing we're kind of missing is we're just not managing rainwater well at all. As a society, you know, we've always looked at upstream and downstream thinking. Let the water company build a new reservoir, let the water company extend its sewage works or build a big storage tank. When actually, as a societal issue, we should be thinking, do you know, our climate is changing. We're moving from this land of drizzle to a land of drought and thunderstorms. Our whole approach to managing rainwater really needs to change. And we need to think about this at the point of consumption or at the point of supply, if you're looking at drainage. So managing the demand for water and the supply of drainage really needs to be addressed at the home. And we are so bad at it at the moment in our society.
And so, Dave, drainage is a key topic, clearly. In terms of the way that we manage drainage in the natural environment, before we are perhaps extracting, abstracting, or equally putting flows back into the systems, what measures can we take to manage water through the water cycle? So, you know, thinking kind of nature-based solutions and management of our rivers, what measures are we taking in the Southwest?
Yeah, I think on the kind of fluvial side, there's kind of more emphasis now on nature-based solutions and actually at a landscape scale. So looking across a catchment, slowing flows down, improving water quality, so that's addressing that flashiness and also those low flows. And then in the urban environment, then that's coming back to these sustainable drainage systems, which are working on those similar principles. Because as Matt says, we've got a real challenge. You know, we've got growing demand that, you know, there's more houses being built, more paved area which needs draining. But we've also got these climate change impacts where our winters are getting wetter and our summers are becoming drier. But then when it does rain, it's much flashier, much more intense. So there's much more pressure on those legacy systems.
And Matt, you mentioned a moment ago storm overflows. I know that's a really hot topic at the minute and elephant in the room, if you like. But what are they? And what are we doing in the Southwest to help keep our waters clean?
Storm overflows are a poor rainwater management problem. Everyone talks about storm overflows being a poo problem, but actually it's a rain problem. When the first sewers were built, and if you go back to the Bazalgette times back in the 1850s, when they built the big interceptor sewers in London, they were always designed to take both the rain and the sewage. And when you look at the comparative volumes between sewage and rain, if your sewage is kind of this big, your rain is this big, because when it rains, the flow builds up so quickly, especially if you're then combining it with your neighbours and then your neighbours and your neighbours. An interesting statistic is that the flow from an average size roof in a 1-in-1-year, 1-hour rainfall event, to try and describe a rainfall event, is equivalent to the same sort of flow that you get from 100 houses where no roofs were connected. So you're talking about orders of magnitude of flow much bigger for when it rains than when it doesn't rain. And so the sewers that were built at the time, they were never going to build them big enough to take all the rain. And so they came up with this idea of, well, when it reaches a certain level of dilution, once the main polluting load has gone through, we'll let them overflow. And that will stop it all backing up and flooding properties. So storm overflows have existed since time immemorial. The difference is we've now started monitoring how often they operate. And that's what's got everyone really excited. Because 5 years ago, no one was bothered or knew about storm overflows because we didn't measure them. We're now approaching 100% monitored, and that is unprecedented across the world. England and Wales are now up there. In Scotland, our neighbouring country, part of the United Kingdom, they're at 4%. A lot of European countries don't know how many overflows they've got, let alone how often they operate. But what's happened is because the number of discharges is higher than everyone thought they might be, the reaction has been massive. However, there's two things missing from the equation. We're missing the impact, because actually, up until now, the impact has been very minor in terms of environmental impact based on the data available. But also, the type of solutions haven't been considered to how you work your way out of this problem. You know, storm overflows, they do have a small impact, but it's not as big an impact as many people think. Part of our problem, I think, is terminology, is that we call it sewage. And if you use the word sewage, everyone just thinks brown, smelly and bits. The reality is, as I said, the sewage is this big and the rain is this big. And it's so diluted, hence the very small environmental impact. But it's a wonderful clickbait for the media, and then the politicians jump on board. And, you know, so it takes on a life of its own because of the terminology and the inference of what it might be without a real understanding of the actual impact. So we've got this huge drive now to tackle storm overflows driven by government legislation, which is looking at reducing discharge numbers, which is fine. But there's a number of issues that I think we need to consider as a society, and that is, how do we address them? And at the moment, everything is kind of based around short-term discharge number targets without knowing whether or not there's any impact at all in the first place. So potential to waste an awful lot of money, which could be spent maybe better focused somewhere where there is impact. But also the way in which we're going about it is generally not in line with the good rainwater management principles. So the good rainwater management principles bind drainage with supply. And there are two. So the two good rainwater management principles are this. Rainwater should first and foremost be considered as a resource, captured locally and reused where possible. You can't really argue with that. It's not rocket science. And the second good rainwater management principle is rainwater should be discharged back to the environment as close to where it landed in the first place as possible, without mixing it with sewage. So you can see that these two principles bring in this integrated approach that we've just been talking about to rainwater. It's not saying storm overflows on their own, but it's saying actually better rainwater management. You can tackle storm overflows and you can tackle the water demand situation that we have as well. So at the moment, we're heading down the, oh, let's just go and build some storage tanks to hold this contaminated rainwater back and then we'll treat it later. Really bad in terms of long-term solutions. It doesn't really cope well with climate change, high carbon footprint. When actually, if we looked at it holistically and said, how can we manage rainwater better by following those principles, that would put us in much better stand for long-term benefits and much wider benefits rather than the kind of short-term discharge number benefits, which is kind of what the targets are. So there are great opportunities, but there are also great challenges with building our way out of the storm overflow situation. And because we're talking about massive changes to infrastructure and huge values, is going to be a slow progress, much slower than some people want it to be, which I think gives us opportunities to steer in the right direction, because I think at the moment we're heading off on probably the non-long-term best option solution. And this is where we need to talk about integrated water management, because if we start thinking like that and we start making legislation and regulation incentivize this better approach, we'll end up with a better solution.
And Dave, I guess just kind of going back to this point on drainage and how we manage stormwater, that's that high intensity rainfall. There's different measures we've heard about in recent years in cities and in natural environments. So we spoke a little bit about those natural solutions, but in terms of cities, something like rain gardens, we've heard that kind of terminology banded around quite a lot. I wonder, could you explain what the principles are around attenuating water in cities and those types of measures that we might use?
Yeah, so I suppose going back to what Matt was talking about, if we think about how we might reuse that water as a resource, which is landing on those paved areas or on your own roof, that's where measures like rainwater harvesting come in. So using that water where it lands for uses where you don't need the water, which is treated to a drinking water standard, but you can flush your toilets. Another kind of uses where you don't need that kind of drinking water, quality water, and you don't need to have gone to that effort to kind of treat that water to that standard. So that's where rainwater harvesting comes in. And then, yeah, we talk about kind of rain gardens. So you've got people doing downpipe disconnection projects. So that's disconnecting the downpipe from someone's house and letting that discharge into a rain garden or over some permeable land to help kind of manage that runoff. Things like rain gardens are a more structured way. I suppose like we would have traditionally used soakaways, which is a kind of below ground structure, discharge out of water into a ground. All a rain garden is, or a swale or some of those other sustainable drainage techniques, are just having that soak away on the surface. So it's a vegetated structure. It can be part of your kind of urban realm and part of greener streets. and it can help then discharge that water, slow it. Some of that water can discharge to the ground. Some of that water can be attenuated, slowed down on the surface and held within that volume. And then some of that can kind of discharge in through your kind of normal systems downstream. It's quite interesting when we think about kind of climate change, and we think about climate change in terms of the water environment, but you think about, well, it's getting hotter in our cities, and things like greening those cities, introducing trees and tree pits, which can also help manage urban runoff. Well, that can also be helping with the kind of urban heat island effects and how hot a place is as well. So that's the kind of benefits you might get beyond just the water cycle and the water environment as well.
And Matt, I'm keen to pick up on those extremes, some of which Dave's just kind of alluded to. So drought, a lot of people in the Southwest have been affected by drought this year. Does it set the benchmark for what's to come?
Yeah, you say that, but in the Southwest they have. In the Wessex area, our last host point ban was, well, when was it? 1976. So yes, and that is because we've been blessed with very big aquifers in the Wessex area, which, you know, are much bigger than the sort of impounding reservoirs, the surface water reservoirs that we have. But yes, extremes. I think that's really important. And Dave alluded to it earlier. What we need to do, both in terms of water demand and in wastewater drainage, is try and flatten peaks. Okay, because infrastructure has to be designed to cope with the peaks. So if you can flatten your peaks, you don't need so much infrastructure. So if our water demand peaks come when? In the middle of the summer, when? At a weekend, when everyone's watering their garden. Now, if everyone was able to use stored water to water their garden, the peaks would be lower. Yes, okay, it might only work for the first weekend, and then the second weekend everyone's water pot is empty, but you flattened a peak. So our kind of approach to demand management must be to try and flatten peaks. And there's a whole number of different ways of doing that, not only from actually gathering rainwater, but also in terms of the value of the product that you're using. If you don't value it, you're going to waste it. If you value it, you'll be a bit more careful about how you use it. Water suffers from being very, very cheap. A litre of tap water will cost you 0.25p, not the kind of money that people kind of worry about generally. And so, you know, watering your petunias with your drinking water doesn't faze a lot of people. And so there aren't necessarily the fiscal levers that help flatten those peaks. And then on the wastewater side, the water butt, which is helping with water efficiency, the overflow to that, or the storage available when the rain comes, is really important for flattening those peaks. And individually, these things do very little. But what we need to do really is scale them up to societal level, such that everyone having a water butt and a rain garden on the back of it will actually make substantial difference and will reduce the need for big new upstream reservoirs and big downstream storage tanks for sewage. And therefore, the extremes that we are now kind of seeing and experiencing and heading towards, we kind of flatten those peaks during the droughts and during the storms and have a far more sustainable solution. So I think the term integrated water management needs to be considered at the home, as well as more holistically in a kind of catchment-wide sense as well. So it's a lovely term because it covers all sorts of bases, and we can probably delve into those in more detail. But I think we should start at the home. And, you know, there are a number of obstacles at the moment. We don't even get it right for new development. New development in the Southwest or anywhere in the country does not require water-efficient homes. Well, it jolly well should do, but it doesn't. At the moment, it doesn't require sustainable drainage. Hopefully that will change next year, when hopefully the government will enact something called Schedule 3 of the Floods and Water Management Act, which was meant to be enacted in 2010. That will make sustainable drainage mandatory for new developments, which is a good step forward. A lot of developments are already doing it. And I think actually measuring what's coming over the storm overflows has really jolted everyone to think you can't keep on adding rainwater to sewage. You've actually got to get rid of it once you've finished using it in a far more sustainable way. And just try and mimic nature. You know, what would happen to that rain if there was no house here? How do we get back as close to the natural situation as possible when us humans come and start making things that are generally grey and impermeable? And I think what we've got to do is start thinking about, and it's not rocket science, none of this is rocket science, it's just about mimicking nature. It's about harnessing nature's resource and then returning it back to nature as close to where it landed. And if we're guided by those principles, then we can start making better decisions, and it will help us manage those extremes that you talked about.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
Dave, of course, we can't talk about drought without talking about flooding, the other end of the spectrum. And I guess, you know, the question I suppose a lot of people be wondering is, flooding, is it just something we need to learn to live with?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it? We're facing rising sea levels, wetter winters, more extreme storm events in the summer or other times of the year as well. And most of our systems and our places we live are designed to our old climate, and we're now in a new and a changing climate. And I think that's quite an interesting question. You know, there's lots of what is an acceptable level of flood risk to live with? How can we design places to be recoverable from a flood event, fast to clean up? You know, flood water in itself doesn't have to be damaging, but can we make properties so that they're easy to clean out, or places where people live, they're fast to recover? We're not damaging things so that people can't recover those. So flood events, I think, is quite interesting. And I think probably how we need to potentially adapt where we live. So is it right to have homes in those floodplains? They may have been fine there before, but with increasing risks, do people maybe need to move away from those areas and maybe use property in floodplains for different uses, ones which are less vulnerable to those flood events? I think that's all quite an interesting discussion. I don't think we've really kind of got to grips with the right answer yet.
Of course, we're now in a post-COVID world, so to speak. We're living with COVID. Matt, I'm interested. The number of people visiting and living in the Southwest has no doubt increased. What sort of pressures is that placing on our systems?
The water demand has gone down over recent years just because of the reduction, the type of industry that used to dominate the demand. Clearly, further down the Southwest, there are huge summer peaks from tourism. At Wessex, we've developed a grid system to be able to shift water around long distances. That was an 8-year project, a lot of money, and it's provided a huge amount of resilience. But that grid doesn't exist everywhere. So the ability to meet demand from supply being further away is not yet integrated. So yes, whilst numbers of people and property levels do go up over time, actual demand has in the long run decreased, partly is because leakage has reduced so much. And as I say, business has changed a lot from industrial to more sort of technology. Water is heavy, so shifting around long distances is quite a carbon intensive process, but we've become accustomed to having endless supply coming out of our taps as a society and very few outages. And so, you know, anything like a temporary use ban on hose pipes is not welcomed by our society. You know, there's this kind of I've paid for it, I deserve it mentality. We've lost, I think, as a society, the resilience to go without for a period of time. I sometimes joke that we should switch the supply off for a few hours occasionally just to remind people of how much a valuable service they get. And indeed, if you've lived overseas or anyone's lived in certain countries, you'll know that your taps don't work all the time. And certainly what comes out of it is not all drinking water. So we're in a very privileged position, actually, in the Southwest and in all of England, in that, you know, what comes out of our tap pretty much comes out of it all the time and is a top standard. We've had it good, and we don't like as a society to go backwards, and therefore levels of investment have to keep up with all the changes that are going on. There are a number of really big and interesting projects to try and address that, and they're called the Strategic Resource Options, and they're all part of an umbrella organization called RAPID, which is kind of an offset of Ofwat, and it's trying to get water companies to work more regionally, so not individual companies. So although we have our own water resources management plan, we also have developed regional plans. And off the back of that, the nation is developing these strategic resource options that are either going to be providing huge more storage capacity or big transfer capacity or big reuse opportunities. And there are a number of those that are in the pipeline, excuse the pun, which will help protect that level of service that we have grown accustomed to over the past few years.
And Dave, we spoke about it at the start of the podcast, this kind of potential disconnect between those looking after our potable, so that's our drinking water and foul networks, and those working in the water environment. So I guess the question is, how do we bridge that gap? How do we work better together?
Yeah, it's really challenging, isn't it? And it's a long-standing issue. And in the flooding realm, it was an area which the Pitt Review identified in kind of this confusing set of bodies responsible for different parts of flood risk management in that case. But then, you know, if you think about the whole of the water cycle, then that gets even more muddied, really, doesn't it? You know, where we have water companies responsible for wastewater, some parts of a surface water drainage, your potable water supplies, but then we've kind of got, you know, the Environment Agency responsible for coastal flooding, district councils responsible for coastal erosion. It's a bit of a mess, and post-pit review, it's probably not consolidated that at all. It's just added new bodies, hasn't it? So that's a real challenge. And I don't think we can expect the government to be changing that in the short term and kind of consolidating those responsibilities across the water cycle. So I think the response to it has got to be those organisations working more effectively together in partnership. And people are starting to work in partnership, but that needs to be kind of happening more consistently across these programs and across the water cycle, across the water companies, the various local government organizations, the Environment Agency, but also people like the Rivers Trusts, and really broadly bringing people together across the water cycle to look at how we can achieve all the objectives we need across the water environment, as well as surfing the demand from water companies' customers.
And Matt, presumably part of the problem is due to funding and cost, as is most things. And so how do we start to break down those barriers? Is there policy interventions we can make or other mechanisms?
Yeah, that's a good question. You can go so far when you work for different organisations with different budgets and different targets. And I think, you know, generally, everyone's pretty good at that. Everyone generally who's involved in, who just parked coastal water, let's go back to rainwater, which is, of course, the source of sewer flooding, fluvial flooding, surface water flooding, and groundwater flooding. Let's call it rainwater. I chaired a legislation review group for DEFRA a couple of years ago that looked at how we could tweak legislation to enable better outcomes, better solutions. Interestingly, a lot of them required intergovernment departmental changes. So it actually needed DEFRA to sit down for the Department for Transport to also sit down with the Department for Levelling Up and Communities, because rainwater just crosses all three of those government departments. And under those government departments, you've got then different organisations, be the local highways authorities or the highways agency, or under DEFRA, you've got Ofwat and the water companies and the EA. And, you know, there are so many different organisations. I mean, a single raindrop can probably pass through about six different ownerships on its way to the sea. Unless you fundamentally change and you create a new government department called rainwater management and an organization responsible for the delivery of rainwater management, you're going to be left with lots of different organizations having to relate and communicate and talk and work together. And as I said, we can get so far with that. And I don't think there's, apart from the kind of budget constraints that different organizations have, the funding mechanisms that each one has and the targets that each one has, you know, we can progress through those with, I guess, the right attitude to a certain extent. But there comes a point where a company's going to say, well, I'm not contributing to that because I don't see any benefits from it. The targets I am set are not going to be addressed by me providing partnership funding into that project. So why would I? I've got budgets to hit. So you're only going to get to a certain point before that whole partnership thing naturally reaches a peak and doesn't get any further. And then the only way to get beyond that is just a different change of approach. And that, as Dave has said, is not likely. It's not on the cards, as it were. It's not likely to happen. Yeah, I think we're probably getting to that point where partnership working is as far as we're going to get in this current structure that we have as a country for managing rain. Yeah, and there's still lots to learn. There's still lots of partnerships to be had. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It comes down to resources and targets, and they're not always aligned because they are spanning different government departments, regulatory bodies, et cetera, et cetera.
So work to be done for us all then.
Yeah. And the attitudinal thing of thinking, take my hat off to the company I work for and think, what's the problem I'm trying to solve? Will go a long way. But as I say, it stops when your budget runs out or your boss says, that's not your target. That's their target. We need to be maybe more altruistic, and we could probably get more out of our limited budgets if we were. But sadly, we have targets to hit, and if they're not the right targets, then we're going to end up with siloed solutions and therefore suboptimal.
I think, though, Chris, to come back on that, the thing which we can change, though, is those targets organisations are set for what they achieve with their money. So thinking about setting those organisations, not just the target which is solely focused on their part of the water cycle, But if they are expected to achieve broader outcomes across that water cycle for their investment, then that will change the type of projects they develop and the outcomes they achieve. And I think that how that funding part and how that money is expected to be spent and the outcomes which are expected to achieve are things which can change much more quickly. You know, we've seen several iterations of kind of funding guidance for flood and coastal risk management projects. Water companies have seen all sorts of different changes in terms of the outcomes they're expected across their asset management cycles. So that is something which could change quickly and could help with some of that partnership working and achieving better outcomes across the whole of the water environment.
Yeah. And that comes back to outcome-based environmental regulation, which is something that we've been trying to push forwards. But often it comes down to outputs. And that's what PR24, that's the next five-year period, is mostly based around, sadly. So going back to the favorite topic of storm overflows, we've been set discharge number targets. There's no outcome targets of no environmental impact at the moment because we are not measuring the environmental impact. So we're just trying to hit these targets of numbers of discharges. You know, the discharge could be a few cubic meters, 1 kilometer out to sea. If there's more than 10 a year, you failed your target. There's no consideration to actually, it's completely pointless doing that because there's absolutely no impact. So we're going to be spending a lot of money, I think, in the initial years, hitting these output targets before we get any measurement of whether or not there's an outcome we should be trying to achieve in the first place. And sadly, you know, it could be wasting an awful lot of money in the process of doing that. I think fundamentally, we measured the wrong thing first as a society. Much as we might credit, I think it was Richard Bennion who said the vast majority of storm overflows need to be monitored by whenever it was, and we're nearly 100%, we should have started measuring the environmental impact of these first to see what needed doing. And it's not impossible because they're doing it in Wales. So, you know, if Wales can measure impact and set targets based on impact, England can, but it's chosen not to.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And hugely insightful. We are almost out of time. So one final thought, Dave. I wanted to ask you, what difference do you think our growing appreciation of the climate is making on our understanding of water as a resource? And do you think young people value water more now than perhaps we did in the past?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I think if we go back to the storm overflows example, people have seen the impact of some of their behaviours and some of the investments in water infrastructure, but I think maybe haven't linked it back themselves in terms of what they can do. So I think there's an appreciation of what some of these climate impacts are going to be and are being already felt. But I don't think people have made the link back to kind of what they can do themselves and their influence on some of those things, which I think is probably a more complex part of the story. But yeah, I think people are starting to be more aware and starting to take those risks more seriously and understand the future that we might be facing and how that might need to change. I think there's a little way to go until people are accepting of what they might need to change themselves in order to kind of try and mitigate some of the worst of those impacts, whether that's where we're talking about water or energy use or any other, or transport or any other of our kind of behaviors. But I think people are more and more aware of those. And we've seen that with, you know, most of the authorities in the Southwest, probably all of them have declared climate emergencies and are starting to think about how they start to work more seriously as organisations towards net zero.
And I guess as infrastructure professionals, it's part of our role to help piece those bits of the jigsaw together and demonstrate to the public that those connections between water networks, the wider water cycle, and indeed the impacts that we're seeing today due to climate change. That is all we've got time for, but it's been such an insightful discussion. Really great to have you both on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. This was the Beyond Brunel podcast. Today we've been talking about how we can secure a sustainable future for water in the Southwest. I've been joined online by Matt Wilden, Director of Infrastructure Development at Wessex Water, and Dave Turner, Coastal Engineer at Moffitt and Nicol. A huge thanks, and look forward to welcoming you back.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.